Welcome. You are listening to Park Avenue Podcasts, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. Today's installment is from the Shapiro Audio Archive. The Rita and George M. Shapiro Audio Archive is a repository of recordings of religious services, lectures, and concerts that have taken place in Park Avenue Synagogue's historic sanctuary between 1954 and 2004. If you want to learn more about the community or the Shapiro Archives, please visit our website at www.pasyn.org. We hope you enjoy this piece of our Park Avenue Synagogue history.
Rabbi and friends, if I seem tonight a bit harried and harassed, it's because I've just come from a lengthy meeting of our core chapters. The meeting began at 1 p.m., and we had expected it would take 2 hours. Instead, we got out at 7:30. And CORE is a very nonviolent organization, but nothing could be less nonviolent than a debate in a CORE meeting, with 20 chapters represented there to discuss where they go from here. Yet I am enormously pleased at the opportunity to be with you tonight and to discuss an issue of great importance. I am pleased for many, many reasons. One reason is that we in CORE and the civil rights movement generally, I think, consider the Jewish people in our country to be important allies in the struggle for freedom, for reasons some of which the rabbi has indicated. And I think the proof of the pudding is in the eating. And the fact of the matter is that there has been an identity of interests between suffering minorities. There is a fellowship or a communion of the sufferers, one might say. And you and your people have much to teach us and everyone else about suffering and its power and about how to overcome it. When I think of this identity of interests, I think of a story which was popular during the war days, World War II, the story of an army camp, where the sergeant received a phone call from a lady in town who told him that she wanted very much to have six soldiers over at her house for dinner on Sunday. And the sergeant replied, "Madam, we'll be delighted to send six soldiers." She said, "But oh, sergeant, just one word of caution. Please see that there are no Jewish boys in the group." The sergeant hesitated momentarily, then said, "Very well, madam, there'll be no Jews in the group." So Sunday afternoon, she answered the doorbell. There were no Jews, but lo and behold, there were half dozen stalwart Negro soldiers standing there. And the lady said, "But madam, there must be," she said to them, "but gentlemen, there must be some mistake." "There must be." I said, "But lady, there is no mistake, but there must be." "Madam," spoke one of the young men, "Sergeant Goldstein never makes a mistake." Well, I would like also to point out that during the Freedom Rides, which was one of CORE's finest moments in history, almost half the Freedom Riders were white, and more than half of the white Freedom Riders were Jewish. This was no accident at all. It was the fact that those who have suffered can understand suffering more. I think, though, that today it is particularly important that even those who have suffered, even the Jewish people of our country, need to study more deeply the nature of the dissent which is taking place in our country, the nature of the protest, and the reasons for it. I am pleased at the opportunity to speak on such a subject as the efficacy of protest. As I was coming up here tonight by subway, I recalled that once before I spoke on an identical subject. This was a number of years ago. The subject had been assigned, in fact, it was in the late days of the war, and on a college campus in Pittsburgh, as I recall it. Now, this time it was almost disastrous. I'll never forget it. The following day, I walked across the campus, and a middle-aged lady stopped me and said, "Now, you're James Farmer, are you?" I said, "Why, yes, madam." She said, "I'm awfully sorry I didn't get to hear you when you spoke yesterday. I'd been planning for a long time to be there. But at the last minute, something turned up, and I couldn't possibly make it." Well, I smiled and said very modestly, "Why, madam, you didn't miss much." She said, "Yeah, that's what they tell me, but I wish I'd heard you just the same." So I'm forced to recall that incident now that I'm duplicating the performance and speaking on the same subject. Yet it is a timely subject. It is a timely subject because the protests are indeed sweeping our country, and today they are involving hundreds of thousands of people. I see no possibility within the next year that there will be a cessation of protests or a decline in the protests. On the contrary, I expect that within the months and the next several years that lie ahead, the protests will step up in intensity and in number of people who are involved. Because this is a protest against discrimination and a protest demanding freedom. It's demanding really what other Americans have fought for and won. Protest is not new in American society and history. The principle, the concept of freedom, which was fought for and won in the Revolutionary War, did not apply to all citizens, did not apply to all people. Originally, it did not apply to women. Women had to struggle for their freedom. They fought under the aegis of the suffragettes, and very often used techniques quite similar to the techniques being used today. There were many times, many occasions, when the suffragettes picketed the White House, when they chained themselves to fences, when they even indeed lay down across roads, when they stopped traffic to bring their case and their issue to the attention of the men of our society and to demand action. They were fighting then for inclusion in the American concept of liberty. Well, originally, working people were not included in that compact of liberty. And working people, laborers, had to struggle through the organization of trade unions to effect their own inclusion. And they, too, used techniques very frequently similar to the ones being used popularly now in the civil rights struggle. They picketed. They boycotted, they marched, they demonstrated, and in Detroit they even sat in the 30s, you will recall. They had the first sit-ins, and they succeeded in winning a large measure of inclusion in the American Compact of Liberty. Well, now, at long last, that method of protest has found its way into the total Negro community of our society. And the Negroes are asking precisely the same thing that women were asking, that workers were asking, namely inclusion in the American Compact of Liberty. We've come to the point at last when the masses of Negroes are no longer willing to accept segregation and to put up with it, to put up with discrimination. This is revolutionary in its sense, in itself. There's been some argument recently as to whether the what is called the Civil Rights Revolution is a revolution or a reformation. Some argue that it is not really revolutionary because it does not seek to overturn the government. It does not seek drastically to change the economy. All that it seeks is in. But I think it is revolutionary in the sense that there has been a change in thinking and a revolutionary change in mood of masses of Negroes in the country, and that they have the agenda in their hands and the timetable. They assist upon the agenda of freedom now, complete elimination of segregation, no more discussion on the old negotiations that took place throughout the South and often in the North, of amelioration, of modifying discrimination and segregation so that it would become more acceptable. But now it's freedom now, and the timetable is now. So in that sense, it is indeed revolutionary. Well, for a long time after slavery, Negroes accepted segregation and discrimination. Didn't like it. Nobody likes being pushed around. Nobody likes being told that he is not as good as other people are. And because of some accident of birth, then his liberty and his freedom must be circumscribed. No one likes it. In spite of what Ross Barnett and George Wallace like to say in their jaunts about the country. In fact, George Wallace is now saying it in Wisconsin in his campaign in the Democratic primary, that our colored people are happy down there in Alabama. And if only those agitators, Northern Yankee agitators, from CORE and the NAACP would stay out of there. All would be peaceful and quiet. Well, that's not true. As a matter of fact, there's an old story told, which you may have heard. I'm sure it's gotten around, about the state of Mississippi being concerned about its public image and hiring a public relations firm from Madison Avenue to do something about it. It said that the state hired a high-priced Madison Avenue firm, which sent two of its brightest young men down to Jackson. They surveyed the situation and decided upon a course of action. They would find one Negro and put him on TV, and it would be a nationwide network hookup, and let him tell the American people just how happy Negroes are in that state. They found a candidate for the job and offered to pay him well and told him he'd only have to talk for 3 minutes. They put him in the studio and sat him down in front of the cameras, told him when the little light goes on underneath the lenses, he should then start talking, and that Americans all over the country were sitting in their living room. They would be watching his face and listening to his voice. And all he had to do was to tell them how happy colored people are in Mississippi, how they just love segregation, and how good the white people treat them. Well, he said, wait a minute, don't turn the light on yet. I want to ask a question. Oh, what do you want to ask? He said, you say they can hear me all over the country? I said, yeah. How about New York and Boston, Massachusetts? Yeah, sure, they can hear you. Detroit, Michigan, California, and Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, they can hear you all over. Now go ahead, speak. So he leaned to the microphone and said, help! Now, no one has liked it, of course, but we put up with it for a variety of reasons. Partly tradition, custom, largely, I think, fear. Mothers have taught their children from the age of first consciousness that they must abide by the etiquette of color, caste, and segregation. They taught them that in order to keep them alive and to allow them to grow to adulthood and live reasonably normal lives. Like all mothers, they love their children. And they wanted them to get along with as little hardship as possible. They wanted them to accommodate to the situation. This kept it going. We put up with it. I did too. Half my life I spent in the South. Born in Texas, lived in Mississippi, and lived in Georgia. While I was in college in Texas, I too put up with segregation. I didn't like it, I know. I hated it. We had bull sessions in the dormitory almost every night, in which one or the other of us railed against segregation. But then, once a week, like all the other students at the college, I walked downtown in Marshall, Texas, into the town square, to the Paramount Theater, walked around to the rear entrance and climbed the back stairs and sat up in the buzzard's roost. The balcony, reserved for color, watching the movie. My conscience didn't bother me then. I saw no real contradiction between saying one thing and doing another. Well, I couldn't do it now. And there are hundreds of thousands of Negroes who couldn't do it now, North and South, who realize that each time they climb those back stairs, they were, by that very act, perpetuating the system of segregation which verbally they sought to destroy. With their words, they said they were against it, but with their deeds, they participated in it, cooperated with it, paid their parents hard-earned money for the privilege of supporting segregation, and thus kept it going. That's the reason segregation has lasted so long. The Negro asked a white man in the South, when are you people going to stop pushing us around? The white man responded with a great deal of wisdom. He said, when are you people going to stop letting us? I think he was right. We share the guilt and the blame for allowing this thing to go on so long by putting up with it and accepting it. I remember talking with my father the day before the Freedom Riders left Washington, D.C. This was on May 3rd, 1961. And at that time, he was in the hospital, Freedman's Hospital, on what proved to be his deathbed. He died while I was on the Freedom Ride. I told him, tomorrow, Dad, I'm going on a Freedom Ride. And he said, Freedom Ride, son, what's that? I explained it to him, told him why we were going to spotlight the contradiction between principle and practice and the gap between the law on one hand and its implementation on the other, and that while the Supreme Court had said we had these rights to ride and use the terminal facilities unsegregated, in practice when we tried we were beaten or jailed, and therefore a small band of us, white and Negro, were going to ride unsegregated, and we were going to demand use of the bus terminal facilities, all of the facilities, the restaurants, the washrooms, the lunch counters, the waiting rooms, and what have you. And we were going to refuse to be segregated and accept the consequences of our action. Well, he said, where are you going? And I told him the states, including Alabama, Mississippi, and Louisiana. He said, Alabama and Mississippi too? I said, yes. Well, the old man thought for a long time and looked up finally and suddenly, and said, well, son, I'm glad you're going on this freedom ride, as you call it, and I hope you survive it. But I realize that for some of you, this may very well be the last journey you'll ever take. But I'm glad you're going, and I'll tell you why. When I was a boy, he said, in South Carolina and Georgia, we didn't like segregation either. We hated it. It burned us up inside. But, he said, we thought that was the way things always had been and the way they had to be, and that there was nothing we could do about it. So we put up with it and accepted it while we burned inside. He went on, I'm glad that there are people today who realize that that is not the case, and that these things can be changed, and are willing to risk a great deal in the effort to change them, even their lives. Well, he was right. Negroes never liked segregation, but accepted it. Why, then, has the protest movement spread so widely? Why have we come to the point where what previously has been acceptable, though reluctantly, ceases to be acceptable, no matter how great the risk? I think there are a number of reasons for it. One reason was the war itself, World War II. Negro lads were in uniform fighting against the master race theory of Nazism. And it was inevitable that at some point they should ask themselves, well, what about the master race theory back home in Alabama or Mississippi or wherever else they lived? Many of them said that they didn't know which way to turn their guns during the war. And they tell the story about a Negro youth in uniform during the war who was on a train heading south, and as he crossed the Mason-Dixon line, the conductor said to him, boy, get up and get into the front coach, the Jim Crow car. The lad ignored the order. It was repeated and ignored again. Repeated again. The young man looked up and said to the conductor, do you see this uniform? He said, yes, I see it. He said, well, I didn't ask them for it. They put it on me. Now they're going to send me to Timbuktu or some other place to fight and die for democracy. Well, if I've got to fight and die for democracy over there, I'd just as soon start here. And the conductor walked away. That feeling was very strong, the bitterness enormously great during the war, not only among the troops, but among their relatives and their friends back home. They said, we've got to do something about the master race theory as it exists in our home communities. Another reason for the new mood among Negroes is increasing education, as more and more of our young people are coming out of high school and going on to college. You can't hold them back. You can't teach them that they are inferior and expect them to believe it, you see. They study the anthropologists, the reports of the American Anthropological Association. They know that science says they are not inferior. They study the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and the tenets of religious faith that undergird our nation, the Hebraic Christian tradition. They cannot study these things without asking, don't they mean me too? And if not now, when? That, I think, is precisely what is being asked now. And it is precisely what those four freshman students in Greensboro, North Carolina, asked on February 1st, 1960, when they sat in at Woolworth. They had gone into Woolworth many times before, but they had used all counters except one previously. This time, they walked over to that one, the lunch counter, and sat down and asked for coffee. Well, it wasn't coffee, really, because they weren't thirsty. They were asking for dignity, for human dignity, for the right to sit there and be served, and to be treated like anybody else, by virtue of being citizens, and more importantly, by virtue of being human beings. Well, a third reason for the new militancy among Negroes is, of course, Africa, the emerging nations of Africa. You know, prior to the independence of the Gold Coast and its becoming Ghana, Negroes had no pride in Africa at all. In fact, chose to forget about Africa. A favorite saying among Negroes in the pre-Ghana days was, man, I ain't lost nothing in Africa. Well, we had the same stereotype about Africa then that most American whites have. And that was the stereotype of Africa being a dark continent with a few half-naked people riding around on backs of elephants and throwing spears through the air at lions and at each other. So Negroes chose to forget Africa. So we alone then, among all American citizens, I suppose, were people without umbilical cords, without roots into the past. And this did something to the self-esteem, to the self-respect, to the pride, and to the dignity. Negroes chose to forget slavery because that was a dark chapter in the history. It was as though then we suddenly had sprung alive as a people in the Reconstruction days, without any roots into the past beyond that. Well, in the past 10 years or so, as the emerging nations of Africa have come up, and Negroes in this country have seen proud black men struggling against great odds, trying to build nations, and sometimes dealing with their problems sensibly and intelligently, and acquitting themselves well in the United Nations, and appearing on television, Negroes have begun to take another look at Africa and developed a greater sense of pride and identity. All of these things, and many others which we won't have time to go into, I think have combined to create the new mood of militancy and the refusal to accept segregation anymore, and thus the protests. Thus the protests that have spread throughout the country. Thus the 100,000 or more who within the past 3 years have been in jail as a part of the protest, the civil rights revolution. Those numbers are going up every day. The protests do not receive the same measure of publicity that they received last spring and early last summer. But they are going on in city after city in the South now. And more are going to jail. Jail holds no terrors anymore. You know, it used to be that the best way to keep a Negro, quote, in his place in the South was to say to him, I'll put you in jail. But that doesn't hurt anybody anymore. People go to jail gladly. In fact, they knock on the jailhouse door and say, open up and let me in. You put my friend in there, put me in there too. If he broke your law, so did I. It's like Thoreau and Emerson. You know, when Thoreau was in jail for conscience sake, briefly, Emerson passed by, it said, and looked through the bars and saw Thoreau and said, why, Thoreau, my dear friend Thoreau, what in the world are you doing in there? Thoreau looked out and said, Emerson, my dear friend Emerson, what in the world are you doing out there? This is the place for honest men at a time like this. Well, that's the spirit, or as one sit-in leader put it, if the road to freedom goes through the jailhouses, then that's where I'll go. And they're going. It doesn't deter them either if they're beaten or shot at. When they're beaten or shot at, it merely spurs the movement and stimulates it and brings more people into the fold of the civil rights revolution that is going on. So it has gathered steam. It is going on. I think really that we probably face more serious problems in the North than in the South at the moment. In the South, we're battering down barriers. We see them coming down. The past 3 years, the numbers of barriers in places of public accommodations and in jobs in specific localities and other forms of discrimination which have been battered down has been quite significant indeed. But in the North, the progress is much slower. This came home to me, incidentally, during a stint in jail in Mississippi as a result of the Freedom Rides. I was there for 40 days in four different Mississippi jails, including the state penitentiary at Parchment. This was for walking into the waiting room labeled for white in Jackson, Mississippi. One day, while we were at Parchment, the state penitentiary, three of the guards came down the corridor and said they wanted to talk to me, motioned me to come to them. One of them was an enormous fellow. When we weren't within earshot of him, we called him the Neanderthal. He was must have been 7 feet tall and about this wide, and I would swear that his arms almost dragged the ground as he walked. Well, he and two of his buddies stopped my cell and motioned me to come up there, said, "Farmer, come here." Well, I should explain that the first day I was there, they called me boy. Well, I protested that at the age of 41, which I was then, I was a little bit old to be called boy. Well, they compromised and began calling me farmer. After several days, they made a really heroic effort. They tried hard to say Mr. Farmer, but the best that would come out was farmer. So for 3 weeks at Parchment, I was farmer. They said, "Farmer, come here." Well, farmer got up and walked to the bars. He said, "We want to ask you something." "Yeah." "You came down here from New York." "Yeah." "You came down here to get rid of segregation." "Right." "Well, here's what we want to ask you. Back up there in New York where you live, could you buy a house or rent an apartment? Any place in the city you wanted to, you had the money to pay for it, live there like anybody else?" Before I could answer, they said, "Just a minute, informer, we've got another question for you. Back up there in New York where you live, could you get a job in business or industry, any place in New York, in keeping with your training and ability, be promoted just like anybody else and earn the same pay, rise to the top?" Well, the only answer I could give honestly was, of course, no. And they chuckled and walked away. I know what their conclusion was. Their conclusion was, therefore, we have no right to be concerned about Mississippi. Well, my conclusion is quite different. It is, therefore, while we have every right to be concerned about Mississippi, we have an equal responsibility to be concerned about New York, to be concerned about Chicago, to be concerned about California, or any city wherever we live. And the protest movement now has come north. We saw it last summer in city after city, the demonstrations on jobs, on housing, and so forth. These problems are more difficult in the North, indeed, far more difficult, because it's not so a simple matter of a sign being posted or a door being barred, either figuratively or literally, and you're not being allowed in. It's a question of mortgage financing of certain homes. It's a question of whether you can get financing for the home and whether the home actually has been sold when you go to apply for it or what have you, or the apartment actually has been rented, or if it's a job, whether the job actually has been taken, whether it was taken just before you walked in, as you might be told, or whether it's true that the other person who was promoted over you, even though you helped to train him in his job, actually might not be better qualified than you. There are all those gray areas in the North. And there is also the fact that there is less frankness about it, because in the South, people say, "Yeah, we keep Negroes out." We do. But in the North, that is not said. In the North, you find greater rationalizations for it. And I would suggest to you, my friends, in all honesty and sincerity, that unless we are able to speed up our progress in the northern cities, including New York, we'll be fighting a losing battle. Now, in housing, residential segregation has become greater in the past 10 years in northern cities. It has not declined. There are more ghettos than there were 10 years ago in northern cities. employment-wise. We're making some progress in some areas, especially managerial jobs. We're getting some management jobs and some highly skilled jobs for a few technicians. But as far as the masses are concerned, we're in serious trouble. Look at the figures. The facts show that the gap between the average income for Negroes and the average income for whites has widened since World War II. It has not narrowed. Now, I would get a laugh if it were not so serious when Governor Wallace of Alabama says that we're making huge progress economically. The Negro standard of living has risen drastically, and now it is several times the standard of living of Negroes any place in Africa. Well, this is a fantastic argument. I don't think that we can compare the standard of living of any people here with the standard of living in Africa. It's totally different land. I think the only basis for comparison is with the standard of living of other Americans. Well, the fact is that in 1950, the average income of Negroes was 54% of the average income for whites. In 1961, the average income for Negroes was 53% of the average income for whites. A slight decline, not a great decline, but a slight decline, yet a decline which becomes all the more significant when you realize that in that 10 or 11 year period, hundreds of thousands of Negroes had moved from the country, the rural areas, to the cities, where one would think that opportunities would be greater and one would think that wages would be higher. But in spite of that fact, there has been a widening of the gap. Actually now, Negroes are more urban than whites. A larger percentage of Negroes live in the cities. And the decline has taken place also in spite of the fact that we have slightly narrowed the educational gap. Yet the income gap has widened. So I think that we're in trouble. You see, automation, the technological revolution, is cutting off jobs. And where is it hurting worse? It is hurting in the unskilled jobs and the semi-skilled jobs. And the overwhelming majority of Negro workers are in those categories. So we are the first being hurt there and will be the hardest hit as automation, the technological revolution, further develops. The only area, the only group of jobs where we have made substantial progress within the past 10 years has been in certain semi-skilled jobs, but those are ones which are doomed by automation. In other words, the trouble is very deep and very real. That is the reason for the anger. The question is frequently asked, why 1963? Why not 1953 or 55 or 1949? Why did it happen in 1963? I think that the reason is very simple. The reason is that these young people, the babies born in the baby boom year following the war, 1946, had come of age and were out in the streets unemployed looking for jobs. Unemployed. And angry, sensing that a part of their plight was due to the color of their skin. There was a study conducted in one gray area of a large metropolitan city, largely Negro in that gray area. And it was found that of all the young people between the ages of 16 and 21, were out of school and out of work, 70%. Then of those young people who had graduated from high school, 50% were out of work, which means that there was no incentive there for the lad or the girl to stay in school. Well, slight incentive. It was reducing his chances of unemployment from 70% to 50%. And that is not much incentive. Well, these young people, alienated from society, were out in the streets last summer. They were out in the streets in the spring. They will stay in the streets. Now, the tactics which they are using may be debated, and I think the debate on tactic is very healthy and should be. the civil disobedience technique or tactic, if it can be called that, has come in for a great deal of discussion, as it should. I think that it ought to be pointed out that the feeling in the Negro community has such great depth at the present time that unless the young people can sit down, can stop on the Triboro Bridge, can go to the World Fair, can somehow with their bodies let the nation know how strongly they feel, then they're going to follow the futile, suicidal gospel of the nationalists, the Muslims and others, unless they have some way of expressing their anger, and unless our society can end their alienation and bring them once again into the fold, I think the entire nation is in trouble. I am very much impressed with the poverty program which the president has fostered. I think that it will make a real contribution to the ultimate solution of this problem. It is yet just a drop in the bucket. The amount of money that has been appropriated cannot, of course, do the job. Yet we know now that we are poor, and this is a basic part of our problem. We know, too, that we are not only poor, we are poor and black, which means that while we have the disabilities of poverty, we have the additional disability of color prejudice. We know, consequently, that we must have fair employment and that we must have full employment, too. We cannot really have fair employment unless we make strides in the direction of full employment, creating jobs for all people. There cannot be the polarization of the national community so that whites are on one side and Negroes are on the other side. I do not think the revolution can be won in such a manner. We today need allies as we've never needed them before. We need Americans to stand up and stop trying to be neutral. There are no neutrals. Can't be. I shudder when I hear the talk of the innocent bystanders. They tell some of our young people as they sit in, as they practice their civil disobedience, trying somehow, maybe crying out in the wilderness, like a babe crying, to impress the American conscience and the American spirit. They say, but what about the innocent bystander that you're injuring? There are no innocent bystanders. Today, as the rabbi pointed out, and I'm paraphrasing his thought, if you're a bystander, you're guilty. Because by your inactivity and lack of involvement, you are thereby, if you're a bystander, helping those who perpetuate the evil. Think of the innocent bystanders in Nazi Germany, who wouldn't speak, who were neutral, it was not their problem. They were as guilty as the others, as a very great rabbi said at the March on Washington, before the 250,000 or more people who stood there. The greatest crime of all is the crime of silence. So they're no neutrals. We've got to take sides in a struggle like this. I was in San Francisco some months ago, shortly after the bombing of that church in Birmingham, where the four little girls lost their lives. And as I sat in the coffee shop at the airport, a white gentleman walked in, sat beside me. He was slightly inebriated, but not drunk. And he said, you know, I want to talk to you. Go ahead, talk, I said. He said, I had a rough ride up from San Diego. What happened? But a man got on the plane, sat down beside me. He was from Alabama or somewhere, and he spent all the time chewing my ear, telling me that we shouldn't be concerned about those four little girls in Birmingham. I said, well, did he convince you? He said, mister, he didn't have to convince me. I'm not concerned. That's not my fight. Maybe it's yours. If it is, go ahead and fight it. I said, but I'm neutral. This struggle. That my job is to make a living for my family and educate my children. See that they have a decent place to live in. But if this is your fight, fight it. And Godspeed. I said, you can't be neutral. He said, I am neutral. I haven't made up my mind which side I want to be on. I was rather belligerent about it. I had to leave then to catch a plane, and on the way out, I turned around to him and said, "Well, brother, I hope you make up your mind soon." He looked down and said, "I'm trying hard not to," and went on drinking his coffee. Well, there are lots of us that are trying hard not to, but I think that we've got to take sides and become involved. I don't mean that everyone has to be in the street with us. Oh, no, not everyone can be in the street. Not everyone can go to jail. But we can make our voices heard in our own way, according to our own lights, to support the goal of freedom and equality, and to help this struggle achieve success. It was another great rabbi, Hillel, who put it in these words, so about 2,000 years ago, I think. "If I am not for myself, who will be for me? If I am for myself alone, what am I? And if not now, when?"
Thank you for joining Park Avenue Podcasts. You have been listening to a selection from the Rita and George M. Shapiro Audio Archive. If you want to learn more about the community or the Shapiro Archive, please visit our website at www.pasyn.org. We hope you enjoyed this piece of our Park Avenue Synagogue history. See you in Shul.